They come to a halt. A hand on the doorknob. The opening door. A woman in a white lab coat enters. She smiles warmly, but not too warmly. She already knows what's happening.
"Who do we have here?"
she asks. I pinch my finger until it hurts.
"This is Lily?"
The woman produces a stool from underneath the examining table, wheels it beside us, and takes a seat.
"What's this on Lily's head?"
She places three fingers under Lily's chin and raises her head very gently to get a better look.
"That's her octa-"
I start to say. But stop.
"Enough is enough."
"That's her tumor?" The veterinarian takes a pocket light and shines it in Lily's eyes. There is no real response.
"Is she blind?"
"Yes, the tumor has taken her eyesight. And just about everything else." She runs her other hand gently over the mass and slowly lets Lily's head rest again in my lap. "She has seizures, bad seizures, and I think dementia. And this morning she looked at me like she was done." This is the last I can say before I have to fight to speak, to do battle for each individual word. "I want you to take her. I want you to take her and to fix her. I want you to tell me you can make everything okay, to make this all go away. And short of that, if you can't do that, if you can't produce a miracle, I want you to tell me I'm making the right decision." There's a panic attack looming. I can feel it. The right decision. The wrong decision. The happy memories. The sad reality. Good, bad, up, down, win, lose, life, death. The doctor holds Lily's head in her hands and covers her ears.
"You are making the compassionate decision.
There will be no miracles. There will be no tomorrows." I nod like my head weighs 100 pounds. And make some sort of noise. Pain mixed with acknowledgement, mixed with consent. Again.
"It's the compassionate decision."
My eyes blur. I'm underwater. Fishful thinking has capsized. I am drowning. How does this work? I already know that I don't want the answer.
"I'm going to take Lily and fit her with a small catheter in her leg so we can easily inject the drugs intravenously. There will be two. The first will render her unconscious. She will be asleep, but still alive. You can have a moment with her to say goodbye. And then when you say, we will inject the second drug to cause cardiac arrest. Once we inject that second drug, it should be over within 30 seconds or so."
"Two drugs," I say. The woman reaches for Lily, but I don't let go. "Right now we're just going to find a vein and fit her with a catheter so things will go as smoothly as possible." She reaches for Lily again, and this time I loosen my grip. She promises to be back in a few moments. I'm alone in the room, and for the first time I can stand. I walk in three tight circles the way Lily does before lying down. Except I don't lie down. I pound my thighs with my fists. I need to feel pain. Physical pain. I slam my arm against the metal examining table in an effort to break something. The pain splinters up to my shoulder, and it feels good. So good, I do it again. But I don't need to break anything. My heart is broken enough. Time stops. Time passes. The woman returns, this time with an assistant. The assistant offers a half smile, but otherwise does her best to be invisible. The veterinarian places Lily on the table. She's still wrapped in my blanket. Her leg is exposed. I can see the catheter. It is taped in place with plastic. I kneel down in front of Lily so that we are face to face.
"Hi, monkey. Hi, tiny mouse. Lily chuffs a few deep breaths. There is a wind coming, I cue her.
Silence. There is no Kate Blanchett. There is no response. She can no longer command the wind, sir. She no longer has the hurricane inside of her. Lily makes one last effort to stand, and that's when I really lose it. We can still run. We can still break out of here. We can still choose life. But what kind of life would it be? Instead, I shower Lily's face with kisses. So many adventures we had. And I loved everyone. Lily's head droops, and I kiss her again. The assistant holds her back legs, and I hold her front. I nod at the veterinarian.
Okay, I'm going to inject the first drug, the anesthesia. She's just going to fall asleep. Sleep well, my beautiful slinkster dog.
The anesthesia is fast. For a few seconds, nothing. But then Lily's eyes open wide as she feels the whoosh of the drug inside her. Then her eyes grow heavy. She blinks once, maybe twice. She staggers left. We slowly lower her to the table where she falls gently asleep.
Let me know when you're ready, and I will inject the second drug.
Wait! I snap. I'm not ready. Oh, God, what have I done? Why is this happening? It's Thursday. Thursdays are the days my dog Lily and I set aside to talk about boys we think are cute. I look at the tape on the catheter, the bandage holding it in place. Rip the band-aid. Quick. It's the only way.
Okay.
I can feel the letters vomit off my tongue. O-K-A-Y. I watch the vet insert the syringe into the catheter and inject the second drug. And then the adventures come flooding back. The puppy farm. The gentle untying of the shoelace.
This is my home now.
Our first night together. Running on the beach. Sadie and Sophie D. Shared ice cream cones. Thanksgivings. Tofurkey. Car rides. Laughter. Eye rain. Chicken and rice. Paralysis. Surgery. Christmases. Walks. Dog parks. Squirrel chasing. Naps. Snuggling. Fishful thinking. The adventure at sea. Gentle kisses. Manic kisses. More eye rain. So much eye rain. Red ball. The veterinarian holds a stethoscope up to Lily's chest, listening for her heartbeat. All dogs go to heaven.
Your mother's name is Witchy Poo.
I stroke Lily behind her ears in the way that used to calm her.
Look for her.
Oh, fuck, it hurts. I barely whisper.
She will take care of you.
I look up at the vet, pleading. Inject me. Give me the poison, too. At least enough to make my heart stop breaking. Anything. Just please, make it stop. After 10 more seconds, the vet pulls her stethoscope away. She doesn't need to say anything. Lily is gone.
I'm so sorry for your loss.
She puts her hand on my shoulder while motioning for her assistant.
Take all the time with her you need.
I don't even notice them leave. Time passes. I don't know how much. I'm aware I'm alone in the room with Lily, and that is the only thing I'm aware of. I kiss the tip of her nose.
Oh, God. Please forgive me.
I'm sitting on the floor with my legs tucked to my chest, and I'm rocking back and forth. The tiniest bit of tongue hangs out of Lily's mouth.
So pink, so still,
so lifeless. So many tears.
I can't remember ever in my life crying this hard. This is some sort of mistake. It has to be. I slide my hand under the blanket and place it on Lily's chest. She's still warm, but her chest does not rise and fall like it does in even her deepest sleeps. I keep it there long enough to make sure, but after some time, even I'm forced to concede that her heart has stopped. I put my head down and sob, as there's nothing much else to do. My brain detaches from my heart and creates independent thoughts. It wonders how long I should stay in here so people don't think that I'm callous. It wonders how long I should not stay in here, how long before people will think that I'm creepy. It tells me to remember every detail of this, that it's important to catalog. So I do. The clock. The white walls. The blanket. The cold, empty chair and the rolling stool. The metal table. How hard the floor feels. How hard my face feels. Lily. Her tongue. The octopus. The octopus. I look at the octopus, and he lies there with his eight arms fallen limp and his one visible eye rolled back in his stupid head. You did this. You could have left, but you didn't. I hope you rot in hell. There's no point in saying it out loud. He can't hear me. The octopus is dead, too. I pull the blanket over Lily's head just enough to cover the octopus, so that it is just her and me, like it had always been. I will love you forever. For the rest of my days, and even all of the days after that. With one last look, I pull the blanket up high enough to cover her completely. It takes me a minute to stand, but when I do, I walk out of the room and, without looking back, I close the door behind me. 1 p.m. I sit in the car for a long time, not knowing what to do or where to go. Eventually, I pull out my phone and call Trent. Lily died. Come to my house. I'll leave work right now. Somehow, I drive to Trent's house. Once in college, I had to drive home to Maine from Boston during the throes of a migraine headache, and when I got home, I had no memory of how I got there. This drive is like that, except the migraine is heartbreak. Trent greets me at the front door and pulls me into a hug, and we both cry, and I say, pills, and he already has them laid out for me. I let Valium dissolve under my tongue, and I kneel down to pet Wheezy. Sweet, sweet Wheezy. She just wants to play. But I can't. I help myself to two shots of this Russian vodka from a bottle I gave Trent for his birthday. We first enjoyed this vodka at the restaurant Red Medicine, a neo-Vietnamese joint that we had sought out because the LA Times named it the bad boy of the Los Angeles dining scene. And it goes down smooth, and it is just that. Medicine. I don't know if it's the vodka or the Valium that takes hold first, but the weight lifts from my lungs just enough so that I can breathe. Trent asks me how it all went, and I tell him as much as I can, but it isn't much. Wheezy is nipping at my heels, but I just can't throw this rope chew she wants me to throw for her, and my head gets very fuzzy. I collapse on Trent's sofa, and he puts on the TV, and we both sit down to watch. But before either of us knows it, I'm asleep. 2 p.m. The waters lap softly at the sides of Fishful Thinking, lulling us into a rhythmic hypnosis. As anxious as we are to get home, I've killed the engines just now so we can drift in the quiet and take in the great beauty that surrounds us. The blue of the cloudless sky matches the blue of the water, and the air is soft, and the sun from the east makes a sparkling golden path for us to follow home. There is total silence except for the gentle sounds of the waters kissing the hull. Since we're stopped, the octopus sinks, and the weight of his corpse raises the hull just enough so that it feels like we're sailing to the heavens. Or at the very least,
wherever Sandy and Danny flew off to when they left Rydell High at the end of the movie Grease. Lily is by my side. I'm almost startled to see her, and I start crying. And since the octopus is dead, Lily looks like her old self, her younger self. There's a lightness to the way she moves. And I hold her head in both hands and scratch behind her ears and just say, "Oh, my baby," over and over again.
"What?"
Lily asks, confused. I say the only thing I can think to say.
"You're here."
I lift her off her perch in the deckhouse, and we stroll out to the bow and lean over the front of the ship.
"Isn't it beautiful?"
"It is,"
Lily agrees. Lily places her front paws on the edge of the boat and stands on her hind legs for a better look. Her tail starts wagging in perfect synchronization with the lapping water. Her inner metronome setting the beat with slow, metrical ticks. And I remember what happiness feels like. I stand back just to drink it all in. If I had the ability to press a button and pause time and live in one moment forever, this is the moment I would choose. A breeze picks up from the northeast, and Lily's ears rise in the wind like the outboard flaps on airplane wings at takeoff.
"What do you see, monkey?"
Lily takes in the expanse between us and the horizon. There's a softness to everything, and it really does feel like we're flying, not floating.
"Everything,"
she replies. "We're going home now, to return to our lives. How do you feel about that?" Lily remains silent, transfixed by the sun's reflection on the water. I wait a moment for her to respond.
"Puppy?"
Lily gives me something of a nod, I think, but she still doesn't really answer me, and this strikes me as odd. My question hangs limply in the air, uncomfortably, like an unreturned "I love you." Why wouldn't she be ready to get back to our lives, to return to the quiet stability of our everyday togetherness? Does she know of something unpleasant waiting for us on shore? Suddenly, red ball falls from the sky and lands on the deck with a deafening thwack. Startled, Lily and I both jump. Red ball bounces in a high arc and lands again closer to the deckhouse. Lily springs into action as it bounces in a series of increasingly smaller arcs toward the stern. She catches the ball in her mouth just before it bounces over the rear of the boat and into the water where the octopus anchors us down. She trots proudly with her catch back toward the bow and plays with it near my feet. It's clear now, the source of her distraction. She never responds to me when she senses red ball is near. My insides settle, and I watch her play as life ambles toward normalcy. It is the perfect moment, a perfect marriage of stillness and life, of beauty and harmony, of aloneness and togetherness. Red ball glides smoothly across the deck of Fishful Thinking, and Lily chases it with ease. And I've never felt more calm. But it doesn't last. Out of the corner of my eye, I see fire in the sky, like a comet, coming toward us with increasing velocity. "What the?" I manage, as the comet grows nearer. A second ball lands on the deck with a wallop and bounces high above us. Lily turns to watch it rebound, confused as to what to do. She looks at the one red ball already trapped under her paw, and then back at the other as it settles near the rear of the ship. I catch Lily's look of confusion just before the third and fourth red balls hit. A shadow falls over the boat, and we both look at the sky as hundreds of red balls blot out the sun. They rain down upon us with increasing ferocity, making a deafening racket. Lily is frozen, terrified, as am I. She might have once dreamed of something like this, but the reality of it is horrifying. We scramble for the cover of the deckhouse, but the red balls come too fast, and I quickly lose Lily in a heap of rubber. I claw and scrape to get to her, to unearth her from the sea of red. But the balls pile up too fast. The ones that hit the water do so with a horrible splash and kick ocean spray into my face. I desperately wipe the salt from my eyes as the balls multiply around my chest,
and there's a tightness, and I can't breathe. And the last thing I remember is screaming, Lily! And then everything goes dark. 3 p.m. Trent's hand is on my shoulder, and I look at him, and there is no pain, just the presence of my friend. And for one brief second, I feel okay, until everything comes rushing back, and it's like someone has their hands around my heart and is squeezing. You were screaming, he says. I was? I was. Yeah. The TV is still on, and Trent has started watching Friday Night Lights, a favorite of mine that I've been trying to get him to watch for years, since he's from Texas and loves football. I'm from Maine, and I hate football, and I still love the show. We watch together, silently. The show is so good, the drugs are still doing their thing, and part of me is transported to West Texas. But only a small part. There is too much pain anchoring me to Trent's couch. At the end of the first episode, when quarterback Jason Street goes down, Coach Taylor gives the first of his trademark speeches. Something about life being so very fragile. Something about us all being vulnerable. Something about how, at some point in our lives, we will fall. We will all fall. I've never played football or any kind of team sport. I've never sat through a coach's halftime pep talk. I've never been in the room with someone rallying the troops to turn the tide of the fight. But hearing Coach Taylor speak, I prop myself up on my elbows. I am 42. This is the halftime of my life, and my team is losing. I've never been more in need of this speech. He continues about how what we have can be taken from us, even what we have that is special. And when it is taken, we will be tested. I'm captivated by his speech, and even though I've heard it before, even though I own it on Blu-ray, I'm also hearing it for the very first time. It is in this pain that we are tested. Since I am in this pain, the pain of having what is special taken from me, I look inside myself, and I don't like what I see. A man who is broken and alone. I think of all the time Lily and I spent together, just the two of us. The talks about boys, the Monopoly, the movies, the pizza nights. And I wonder how much of it was real. Dogs don't eat pizza. Dogs don't play Monopoly. I know this on some level, but everything feels so true. How much of it was an elaborate construct to mask my own loneliness? How much of it was built to convince myself the attempts I made at real life, therapy, dating, were not just that, attempts? Somewhere, sometime, I stopped really living. I stopped really trying. And I don't understand why. I had done all the right things. I had Lily. I had Jeffrey. I had a family. And then I didn't. I don't understand how my life got so empty, or why the octopus came, or why everyone eventually goes away. 4 p.m. Trent orders pizza, and when it comes, I try to eat, but the first bite makes me retch, and I think I'm going to throw up, but I overcome it, and manage to keep it down. The red peppers and tomatoes and olives and cheese mix with the bile that rises in my throat, and everything tastes awful. And yet I keep eating. Every bite delivers a stomach pain so sharp that for one glorious nanosecond, it overcomes the one in my heart. There are three empty Pacifico bottles in front of me on the coffee table, which I don't remember drinking. I look over at Trent, and I can tell he's happy that I'm eating. I guess the idea of someone overdosing on booze and pills on his couch, if one could overdose on a Valium, two shots of vodka, and three Pacificos, is not one he relishes. Good pizza? He asks. I raise a slice to him like I'm offering a toast. Why didn't I run? Why didn't I scoop Lily up in the blanket and take her home? If I had, we would be there now, together. It's the question I can't get out of my head. Why didn't I run.
Wheezy sits expectantly, hungrily, in front of Trent. And I forget again if dogs do or don't eat pizza. I don't know what I'll do when it's Wheezy's time, Trent says. I know he says this because he's experiencing some of my pain, coupling it with imagined future pain of his own, trying to understand. Plus the not knowing what to say that all of us experience in the face of grief. And I appreciate it, I do. But it's not Wheezy's time. She is here. Unscathed. Alive. He also has Matt. What do I have? The distribution of loss is inequitable. And I don't want him to not have Wheezy. And I don't want him to not have Matt. I love my friend. And I want him to have every happiness. So I say this as a realization only. Not as a desire to redistribute loss or to make it more equitable. The distribution of loss is inequitable. That's just the way it is. That's just the way the world works. There's no one handing it out. There's no one making sure everyone gets a fair share. So many adventures we had. And I loved everyone. Had. Past tense. Did Lily know this as her eyes grew heavy? That the adventures were over? Or did she feel the heaviness of sleep as the onset of a satisfying rest? One that would allow her to be fresh for new adventures ahead? Was it exciting? Or terrifying? Or did she see nothing at all? I think of Cal and rub the tattoo on my arm. To die would be an awfully big adventure. But it's not true. Life is the real adventure. Having the hurricane inside you is the true adventure. And then I think not of Cate Blanchett as Queen Elizabeth I, but of Mel Gibson as William Wallace. Everyone dies. Not everyone really lives. And then of Mel Gibson in the movie Ransom. Give me back my son! The pizza makes me listless, and I lie down again. I'm vaguely aware of Trent taking my plate so that Wheezy won't eat the crust I've left untouched. Pizza bones, my dad called them. Bones. Remains. Ashes to ashes. Dust to dust. I try to focus on getting back to fishful thinking. On getting back to Lily. On rescuing her from the meteor storm of red balls. I will try harder this time to get to her, to save her. I will grab her, and we will run. The fact that we are on a boat surrounded by water and there is no place to run to is of little consequence. This time we will run. Except when sleep comes, I do not dream of Lily. 5 p.m. What are these? Trent is holding pamphlets. I don't know. I sit upright and then lean on some throw pillows. I've never seen them before. The pamphlets. The room is vaguely spinning and the TV is still playing Friday Night Lights. And this time, I don't need to be reminded what happened. I wake up already knowing. Trent thumbs through them before saying, oh. He places them on the coffee table. What? Nothing. You can read these later. I reach forward and my abs hurt in the way they do when I've been working out a lot, except I can't remember the last time I've seen the inside of a gym. Weeks ago, maybe. When I pick up the pamphlets, I immediately regret it. Pet mortuary. Pet crematory. Pet burial grounds. Words jump out at me and assault my eyes. Respectful handling. Individual cremation. Selecting an urn. Bereavement counseling. Fine products. Compassionate care. Each phrase is a new stab at my heart. Trent takes them from me. Where did you get those? I ask. I accuse. They were here on the table. Someone must have put them in my hands before I left the animal hospital, but I have no memory of it. Did I drive here with them clutched in my hands? I have no memory of that either. I'll put them over here with the letter. There's a letter? You can read it later. You don't need to read it right now. Dear sir, we were able to remove the octopus after all. Your dog is fine. Please come pick her up at your earliest convenience. She is excited to see you. Yours in science, the Animal Hospital. What does it say? I don't ask. This is an order for him to tell me. There is no reading it later. I need to know. I need to know what the letter says, now. Trent sighs. He opens the letter, which is folded in thirds. He scans it until he gets to the end. You have until Monday to decide what you want to have done with Lily. He reads me the options. If I choose individual cremation, I can shop for an urn. Bring her home. If I choose group cremation, they will dispose of the cremains for me. There are other packages for burial. One includes a precious clay paw print keepsake. All of this tests my beliefs. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in an afterlife. I do believe you live and you die. I do believe death is eternal nothingness. I do believe the body is just a shell. I do believe Lily is no longer there. There is no deciding what to do with Lily. There is no more Lily. There is deciding what to do with her body. None of this frightens me. Or does it? I don't need Lily's remains to remember her by. I don't need an urn to remind me of her love. I don't need a precious clay paw print keepsake to remind me that life is fragile, temporary, short. Or do I? Do I need them so that I know I loved her? Do I need them to know that she loved me? Can I stomach the idea, years from now, of not knowing where her body is? Stop all the clocks. Cut off the telephone. Prevent the dog from barking with a juicy bone. It hits me. Lily's body is in some freezer, stacked with the bodies of other unfortunate dogs. That's how they can still make a precious clay paw print keepsake. Trent puts the pamphlets with my keys on the dining room table. I don't have to read them now. 9 p.m. My phone is ringing, and it's Jeffrey, and I don't want to answer it. Before I got in the car, I sent him a text. Lily passed away. I was with her at the end. I'm not able to talk about it yet, but I thought you should know. And then a second text. Thank you for being an important part of her life. I'm not able to talk about it yet. My phone is ringing. It's Jeffrey. I grip the steering wheel with both hands and concentrate on the freeway and the lane ahead of me. I think back to our relationship and my saying explicitly, these are the things that if you do them, they will hurt me, and his uncanny ability to do just those things anyway. I'm not able to talk about it yet. Talking about it would hurt me. So what do you do if you're Jeffrey? You call to talk about it. Just as I decide not to talk to him, to let the call go to voicemail, knowing I may never listen to the message, my fingers betray me and answer. Hi. Hi. It's been a long time since I've heard his voice. It sounds familiar, yet foreign. You're driving? Home. From Trent's. I didn't think you should have to drive home alone. It's the Bluetooth feature on this car, new since our breakup. His voice spills from the stereo speakers surrounding me on all sides. It's unnerving. There's a long, empty pause before I say, thank you. And then, where are you? I'm home. I laugh. Why is that funny? Why is it funny? I don't even know where home is for you now. How could I not know where he lives? I can picture a few of his things, things that used to be ours. But I can't picture them in the context of any space. Do you want, like, an address? I'm suddenly panicked that he might invite me over. That's okay. I'm driving. Silence. She was a good girl. Another long pause.
the best.
I agree. I pass the exits for Vineland, Ventura, and Lancashire before we speak again.
What happened to us?
Jeffrey asks. Is this the right time to be honest? I don't have anything left in me to be otherwise. You weren't as faithful as I needed you to be. Jeffrey swallows.
You never seem fully invested.
He says it without anger or retaliation. We are just stating facts. Fireworks burst over the Universal Studios theme park, their last embers raining over the freeway, just as our statements now are the dwindling cinders of explosive arguments we had long ago. I know. That much is on me. Another silence you could drive a truck through.
We had a really good run for a while,
Jeffrey says. I think so, too. As I pull the car to the right to prepare to exit on Highland, I tell Jeffrey I have to go.
Take care of yourself, Ted.
The way he says it, I can tell it's the last time we'll ever speak. You too, Jeffrey. It feels weird that we use our names. Names are for people who are less acquainted than we are. My finger hovers, paralyzed for the briefest of seconds, before I disconnect the call. Ted and Jeffrey. We are strangers again. I open my sunroof and crank the radio. Cecilia by Simon and Garfunkel is playing. But in my head, Cecilia sounds too close to Lily, and I change the station to something else. Something that means nothing. Something I don't recognize. Something angry at life. Pulling up to my house is such a normal activity that I almost think the whole day hasn't happened. I wonder what I was doing at Trent's. I wonder why Jeffrey had called. Lily is fine. She's waiting for me, asleep in her bed in the kitchen. May take her a minute to perk up when I walk in the door. She's been a terrible watchdog these past few years. But she will wake up. She will wake up when I walk in the door. As long as I sit in the car, this is true. Once I go inside, this is not true. As long as I sit in the car, this is true. I've so convinced myself that when I do work up the courage to go inside, I stand in the dark, unwilling to turn on the lights, to do anything that might shatter my delusion. Finally, when the darkness becomes deafening, I whisper,
Lily?
Silence. Of course there is no answer. I got out of the car. 11 p.m. There's an empty bottle of vodka in the freezer, and I don't know why it's there or why there's not a full bottle. I toss it into the recycling bin. Then I take the unopened bottle of vodka from the cabinet and the remaining beer in the refrigerator, and I dump them down the drain. I do this before undertaking the somber task of putting Lily's bed out of sight in the closet. I take her paw print blanket and hold it up to my face, inhaling deeply before folding it neatly and placing it on top of the laundry. I lift her food and water dishes off the floor. I don't even wash them. I just empty them and put them in a drawer. There's a stray piece of kibble hidden under her food bowl. Unfinished business. My bed is unmade. In the middle is a nest of towels where Lily slept her last night. I strip the bed and under the towels find an empty trash bag laid out over the sheets. I don't remember putting it there, or even having the thought to do so. I flip the mattress even though it's dry, and make the bed with clean sheets. Slowly I'm erasing the events of today. I take a hot shower and stand for a long time under the spray. I'm aware that I'm washing her off me, removing her from the spots where we last touched. I turn off all the cold water until the hot water scalds, and when I can't stand the pain any longer, I turn the cold knob until the water becomes temperate again. When I get out of the shower, I forget to even dry off, and I just stand there next to the open window in the thick July air, looking out into the darkness of the backyard. Tomorrow is Friday. Therapy with Jenny. How will I speak of this with her? On Fridays, we play Monopoly. I find some shorts on the floor, flop down onto the sofa, and turn on the TV. I look down at my legs, and they are splayed in a way that creates a nook for Lily, the one she would always step into, turning around 3 times and then falling asleep in. Her chin slung over the bend in my knee. This is how I sit now. I never sat like this before. This is how I sit now. Lily has fundamentally changed me. What was the point of grieving early? That's what I will ask Jenny. If the point was to alleviate the grief I feel now, to make it malleable, to spread it thinner in a more manageable fashion, grieving early had utterly failed. If I was detaching weeks ago, shouldn't it be easier to fully detach today? There will be 2 drugs. I want to go back to that space in between them. After the first, where she is no longer in pain, just floating on a peaceful cloud of sleep. Before the second, where her heart still beats and her chest still rises and falls, and that little bit of pink tongue is still tucked safely inside her closed jaw. Midnight encroaches, and I want to stop the clocks. Tomorrow will be the first day that Lily never saw. There's an overwhelming desire to run away. The octopus came when I was away. All this time I have felt at fault, the one to blame. But suddenly I am overcome with a wave of anger at Lily. She used to bark at the mailman, bark at the wind, bark at every passing car. She used to race to the front door to scare away potential attackers, her silly body rigid with readiness, her nose pressed through the wooden blinds to smell danger. Her bark that of a much larger dog. She used to dash to the door whenever I got home. She used to be diligent when things would go bump in the night. But somewhere along the line, she aged. She got older and harder of hearing and maybe lazy or just impaired. Whatever the cause, she let her guard down. She failed to protect us. That is when the octopus came. She is the one at fault. She is the one to blame. Or maybe the octopus tricked her into submission. He was that wily. He could have come prepared. He could have come unannounced. The octopus, after all, is a master of camouflage. It's impossible to focus my anger. Why did I think we would be together forever? Lily never made that promise. Dogs don't live as long as people. In my head, I knew this. But to think that there would come a day when we would part was to take the joy out of a day we had together. A day together at the beach. A day together taking naps and walks. A day together chasing squirrels. My body fights with my mind for rest. My eyes grow heavy and yet still resist sleep, but I don't know why. I need sleep. Desperately. Maybe I fear the return to fishful thinking, now that I know it does not end how I thought it did. Now that the journey does not return us home. I finally break free of my repose and wander aimlessly through the house, turning off switches wherever there is light. When I get to the kitchen, I find Red Ball staring at me from the linoleum floor, and my eyes water again. I lean down to retrieve it. It's impossibly fixed to the floor, like the sword in the stone. It takes a long time to move it, but, like Arthur, I do. And I tuck it in the drawer with her food. I turn off the kitchen light. She was 12 and a half in actual years, which is 87 in dog years. I'm 42, which is 294 in dog years. We had 12 brilliant years together. That's 84 in dog years. That's a lifetime, even if dog years pass too quickly. A heart is judged not by how much you love, but by how much you are loved by others. There will be 2 drugs. The second will stop her heart. Good night, my sweet puppy. Good night, monkey. Good night, silly goose. Good night, tiny mouse. Good night, bean. Good night, Lily. You were fiercely loved. three hearts. August. I'm already parked when it occurs to me I'm not sure which of the two Starbucks is the one we agreed upon. It's now 2 minutes until 3, the time we planned to meet, and so I should probably hope for the closer of the two, even though the farther would be a much better choice for a first date. At least there we could sit outside. How can there be two Starbucks in one location? One is inside a Barnes & Noble, that's how. The Starbucks of books. I text him quickly and start in the direction of both Starbucks, and when he texts back, he asks, "How do you feel about frozen yogurt instead?" I write back, "Sure," and head to the farther Starbucks, since it's closer to the frozen yogurt place. Even though now it's probably more complicated than ever, the plan about where to meet. It's been a month to the day since Lily died. Until today, I've been doing okay. I took my mother up on her offer to come home. I timed my visit with Meredith's, and we all spent a few lazy days enjoying the Maine summer. And no one pressured me to talk, or to laugh if I didn't want to. Upon my return, I threw myself into other things. Work, exercise, a lot of running. Running to, running from. Catching up with friends. Dating, sort of. There have been a few dates. All firsts, no seconds. No real interest on my part. Afternoon dates, all of them, so that it's not a big deal when I don't drink. All of this is not to say there weren't a few dark days, even lonelier nights, and a few horrifying nightmares, but I powered through somehow, kept marching forward. It seemed critical rejoining the world. I have been away too long. I've been dreading today, the one-month anniversary of Lily's passing. But I hadn't expected it to land with such a numbing clonk. I probably only made this date knowing I would need the distraction. Not that I didn't find his pictures attractive, not that I didn't enjoy our email exchange. I think I'm attracted to his name. Byron. A poet's name. Romantic. I've read a lot of Lord Byron of late. He had a Newfoundland named Boatswain, who was the inspiration for one of his more famous works, Epitaph to a Dog. Near this spot are deposited the remains of one who possessed beauty without vanity, strength without insolence, courage without ferocity, and all the virtues of man without his vices. Boatswain, it seems, was a lot like Lily. It felt like some sort of sign, my date's name being Byron. He would understand me in the depths of my pain. He would speak in poetry, real emotional verse, and not pablum and platitudes. But I don't really know what I'm doing as I march toward the farther of the two Starbucks, the one closer to the yogurt place. Living, I suppose. Breathing. It seems I'm almost ready to do those things again. Not just go through the motions, but attempt them for real. I weave through L.A.'s famous farmer's market, which is really more of an outdoor food court. And now I'm a few minutes late, and the place is packed, and there's still the uncertainty about where to meet when I look down and realize I'm wearing yellow pants. Yellow pants. Really? Sometimes I don't know what I'm thinking. They're rolled at the cuff and paired with a navy polo, and it looks like maybe I just valeted my yacht and I'm certain to come off as an asshole. I think about canceling, or at least delaying so I can go home and change. But the effort that would require is unappealing, and this date is mostly for distraction. And when I round the last stall, someone selling enormous eggplants, more round than oblong, I see him, casually leaning against a wall, and something inside my body says, "There you are." There you are. I don't understand them, these words, because they seem too deep and too soulful to attach to the farmer's market, this Starbucks or that, a frozen yogurt place, or confusion over where to meet a stranger. They're straining to define a feeling of stunning comfort that drips over me, as if a water balloon burst over my head on the hottest of summer days. My knees don't buckle, my heart doesn't skip, but I'm awash in the warmth of a Valium-like hug, except I haven't taken a Valium. Not since the night of Lily's death.
Yet here is this warm hug that makes me feel safe with this person. This Byron, the maybe poet. And I want it to stop. This, whatever this feeling is, can't be a real feeling. This can't be a tangible connection. This is just a man leaning against a stall that sells giant eggplants. But I no longer have time to worry about what this feeling is, whether I should or shouldn't be here, or should or shouldn't be wearing yellow pants, because there are only maybe 3 perfect seconds where I see him, and he has yet to spot me. 3 perfect seconds to enjoy the calm that has so long eluded me. There you are. And then he casually lifts his head and turns my way, and uses 1 foot to push himself off the wall he is leaning against. We lock eyes, and he smiles with recognition, and there's a disarming kindness to his face. And suddenly, I'm standing in front of him. There you are. It comes out of my mouth before I can stop it, and it's all I can do to steer the words in a more playfully casual direction so he isn't saddled with the importance I've placed on them. I think it comes off okay, but as I know from my time at sea, sometimes big ships turn slowly. Byron chuckles and gives a little pump of his fist.
Yes, it's all happening for us!
I want to stop in my tracks, but I'm already leaning in for a hug, and he comes the rest of the way, and the warm embrace of seeing him standing there is now an actual embrace, and it is no less sincere. He must feel me gripping him tightly because he asks,
Is everything okay?
No. Yes, everything is great. It's just...
I play it back in my head, what he said, the way in which he said it, and the enthusiasm that had only a month ago gone silent. You reminded me of someone, is all.
Hopefully in a good way.
I smile, but it takes just a minute to speak. In the best possible way. I don't break the hug first, but maybe at the same time. This is a step. Jenny will be proud. I look in his eyes, which I expect to be brown like Lily's, but instead are deep blue, like the waters lapping calmly against the outboard sides of fishful thinking.
Is frozen yogurt okay?
Frozen yogurt is perfect. We sit across from each other with our yogurt, which is a better choice in the August sun than coffee. His is plain and mine is pomegranate. I'm surprised that he looks both exactly like and nothing like his pictures. The way he moves, the way he smiles, it makes him more handsome than anything a still photograph could capture. We run through the usual first date banter, and I start to tell one of my stories, and even though it comes off okay, when I finish, I tell myself to stop it. This one is worth being present for. He is from New Orleans. He used to be a TV news reporter in Las Vegas, and I wonder how that is because his hair curls and it moves in the breeze and he kind of looks like the poet his name suggests, and nothing like a TV news reporter, at least any that I've seen. He's an uncle, like I am an uncle. He's close with his mother, but not his father. He's sad about the death of Whitney Houston. He loves dogs.
Have you ever been in love?
Byron asks. I pause and think of Lily, even though I know that's not what he means. I answer yes, because even if there had never been a Lily, it's true. I even go so far as to try to mask the pain of it. You? He looks sheepishly at his feet.
I don't think so.
And then he adds a hopeful,
Not yet.
I recognize in his face the look of someone who has been on a lot of these dates. And I admire his ability to remain hopeful.
How long was your last relationship?
He asks. 6 years.
How did it end?
I pause. I mean, if you don't mind me asking.
I don't mind, I say.
I ended it.
Why?
And then with a chuckle, I have a tendency to be direct. I look at him and weigh the advantages of several lines before deciding the best way to answer directness is by being direct in return.
Because I thought I deserved to be treated better,
good for you!
I look around at the crowd and wonder if someone is playing a cruel practical joke. Like I might see the octopus in human form 5 tables away, sipping an iced latte and saluting me with one of his tentacles. But the octopus is dead. I know that. And I don't think this is a joke. I think this is who this guy really is.
When did you know it was over?
In the days leading up to the election, when marriage equality was on the ballot in California, he talked about us getting married. I had such a visceral reaction to tying my life to his that I thought about casting my vote to make gay marriage illegal, denying all gay Californians their basic civil rights, just to avoid an uncomfortable conversation at home. Byron laughs. I guess that's when I knew it was over. I put my hand on his forearm. I don't know why I do this, and it's not exactly natural, although it's not unnatural. Except that I really want to touch his skin. It's smooth and tan just a little bit, and feels like summer. Like something familiar and warm and good. Like my skin did on the first days aboard Fishful Thinking, before it salted and burned and peeled. We broke up 3 years after that. I sit back in my chair and give a sly smile. Relationships are complex, and sometimes you can't really explain them to an outside party. Can't believe I just told you that.
Yes! You are living your full life!
A third time. I'm not imagining it. There you are. This time my heart does skip a beat. I look down at his arm, and we're still touching. And he has made no attempt to retract his arm or retreat. All my surroundings, the red formica tabletop, the pink yogurt, the blue sky, the green vegetables in the market, they all come alive in vibrant technicolor as the sun peers from behind a cloud. I am living my full life. Honesty in all things, Byron adds, lifting his cup of yogurt for a toast of sorts. I pull my hand away from him, and the instant my hand is back by my side, I miss the warmth of his arm, the warmth of him. Honesty in all things. I should put my hand back. That's where it wants to be. That's Lily's lesson to me. Be present in the moment. Give spontaneous affection. I'm suddenly aware I haven't spoken in a bit. Did you know that an octopus has 3 hearts? As soon as it comes out of my mouth, I realize I sound like that kid from Jerry Maguire.
Did you know the human head weighs 8 pounds?
I hope my question comes off even a fraction as endearing. No, Byron says, with a glint in his eye that reads as curiosity. At least I hope that it does. But even if it doesn't, I'm too into the inertia of the trivia to stop it. It's true. One heart called the systemic heart that functions much like the left side of the human heart, distributing blood throughout the body. Then 2 smaller branchial hearts near the gills that act like the right side of our hearts to pump the blood back.
What made you think of that?
I smile. It may be entirely inappropriate first date conversation, but at least it doesn't bore me in the telling. I look up at the winsome August sky, marred only by the contrails of a passing jet, and a vaguely dachshund-shaped cloud above the horizon. I don't believe in fate. I don't believe in love at first sight. I don't believe in angels. I don't believe there's a heaven and that our loved ones are looking down on us. But the sun is so warm, and the breeze is so cool, and the company is so perfect. And the whole afternoon so intoxicating, it's hard not to hear Lily's voice dancing in the gentle wind.
1 month is long enough to be sad!
I want to argue with Lily. 1 month is not long enough. But in dog months, that's 7 months. Over 200 days. But none of it matters. To her, even 1 day of my sadness was 1 day too many.
I pick up my spoon and swirl it around the bottom of my empty yogurt dish.